Let's open our Bibles. We'll be in Ecclesiastes, chapter 11. Ecclesiastes, chapter 11. You know, good lives, really good lives, are rare. You say, oh, no, there's lots of good lives. There's lots of Christians anyway. That's true. There are many saved lives. But that's not what I said. I said good, meaning wise, balanced, godly, lives with depth and texture and perspective, lives that live by the wisdom of God and aren't just saved by the skin of their teeth, lives that take seriously everything God says. Now, these people are rare in this world. And perhaps there's a number of them here on a Wednesday evening for a Bible study. Perhaps being at a Bible study in the middle of the week might indicate that you have some wisdom and some texture and some depth in your life. But it's not a guarantee. It's not a guarantee that you're going to be wise and lead a good life simply because you're saved. If you think that's true, then you're not looking around at the rest of the folks in the world who are calling themselves saved. And I'm not being harsh. This is a reality. You can come to Jesus Christ and then, in significant areas of your life, decide not to think like he does. And to the extent that you do that, you're going to not live what he would call a good quality life. And that's a shame, because he cares about the quality of life that we live. He cares about the joy. He cares about the laughter. He cares about the sorrow. He cares about the wisdom. He cares about the investments. Doesn't that sound strange? But he does. And yet, really good quality lives are hard to find. I came across this, one of my favorite authors, Eugene Peterson. He says this, "The puzzle is why so many people live so badly. Not so wickedly, but so inanely," he says. "Not so cruelly, but so stupidly. There is little to admire and less to imitate in the people who are prominent in our culture. We have celebrities, but not saints. Famous entertainers amuse a nation of bored insomniacs. Infamous criminals act out the aggressions of timid conformists. Petulant and spoiled athletes play games vicariously for lazy and apathetic spectators." What a week to mention that. "People aimless and bored amuse themselves with trivia and trash. Neither the adventure of goodness nor the pursuit of righteousness gets headlines. Modern man is a bleak business," says Tom Howard. "To our chagrin, we discover that the Declaration of Autonomy has issued not in a race of free, masterly men, but rather in a race that can be described as bored, vexed, frantic, embittered, and sniffling. This condition has produced an odd phenomenon. Individuals who live trivial lives and then engage in evil acts in order to establish significance for themselves. Assassins and hijackers attempt the gigantic leap from obscurity to fame by killing a prominent person or endangering the lives of an airplane full of passengers. And often they're successful because the media report their words and display their actions. And writers vie with one another to analyze their motives. No other culture has been as eager to reward either nonsense or wickedness." Isn't that interesting? "If, on the other hand, we look around for what it means to be mature and whole and blessed as a person, we don't find much. These people may be around, maybe as many of them as ever, but they aren't easy to pick out. No journalist interviews them. No talk show features them. They are not admired. They are not looked up to. They do not set trends. There is no cash value in them. No Oscars are given for integrity. At year's end, no one compiles a list of the 10 best lived lives." End quote. Isn't that the truth? At the end of the year, when you read in all the magazines and you see all the stuff, you know, no one has a list of the 10 best lived lives. Because the best lived lives, folks, are pretty much invisible to everybody around us. They're fairly rare. Are you living one of them? Are you living one of those best lived lives? And do you think it's worth living even if no one else knows about it? Do you think if it's the quality that God wants, so you're not a celebrity? You think it's still worth living for God under those circumstances? I hope you do think that. Because, of course, it's true. And that's where the quality of life really is. That's part of the wisdom that God gives to us. And that's part of the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. As a matter of fact, Ecclesiastes, wisdom through the back door. Wisdom through the sort of depression of looking at what the world does and finding out that the world really doesn't have much to offer in the way of wisdom. Yet we learn a lot from Ecclesiastes, Solomon, and his dark wisdom. We're in chapter 11, and we're going to see in chapter 11, which isn't really a very long chapter, it's only 10 verses, but we're going to see four ways to live daily and wisely. And you might be surprised by what'll come out of this chapter. And I trust you. How many of you, raise your hand if you've been a little bit surprised at what you've heard in the book of Ecclesiastes in the first place? Yeah, me too. I'm surprised when you really dig into the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, I'm surprised what I find there. And not only I, but other people who've written on the subject. It's fascinating, and we've overlooked it. Well, we're going to see a few more kind of surprising things. They're in keeping with the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, but they're surprising to hear in a Christian pulpit, I think, at least to a certain extent. Four things that we're going to see, and you'll see also some words that you may be familiar with in Ecclesiastes 11. All of these things, by the way, and I'll give them to you one at a time, all of them have to do with what you do with your life and how wisely you live it and how to live it wisely for God. Here's the first one. I'll give it to you, and then we'll read the verses. Invest your life rather than hoarding it. First piece of wisdom we're going to look at from God about walking with God and living our lives is invest your life rather than hoarding it. Don't circle the wagons. Don't try and save your life up. Remember what Jesus said, if you lose your life for me, you will gain it. Well, Solomon in Ecclesiastes, in the first couple of verses of chapter 11, says very much the same thing, and he's talking about serious investment of money and life. Cast your bread upon the surface of the waters, for you will find it after many days. Divide your portion to seven or even to eight, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. He's saying basically two things. He says, cast your bread upon the water. How many of you have heard that and didn't know it was in the Bible? Are you honest to admit that? Okay. I certainly was, the first time I read this, which happened to be several years ago, but nevertheless, I was surprised. I thought, hey, wow, there's something I already knew. I knew that line, cast your bread upon the waters, it'll return to you after many days. I never understood what it meant. I saw this soggy French bread sinking, you know, in the water. I had no idea what was going on. The bread he's talking about isn't really just throwing physical bread upon the water. What he's talking about actually has to do with investment, believe it or not. It has to do with putting out an investment without knowing exactly how it's going to get back to you. It's not a guarantee. In fact, some of the scholars who work on this passage make it pretty clear that to invest across the waters, across the oceans, from Israel was really one of the only ways to make large profits because Israel was such a small nation. You had to deal internationally in those days. And by the way, a ton of international trade was done by Solomon. I don't know if you've ever done any research on that and ever read about Solomon, but he did a huge international trade to the ends of the earth. His emissaries went and they did a very lucrative trade. What this is often interpreted as being is give, throw what you have out there, and it'll come back to you. It might mean that, but actually the context of the passage is investment. The problem with casting your bread on the waters or even across the waters, with investing in something you have no control over. Once the bread floated, by the way, it was these hardened little loaves. You could toss it out there, it'd float like a ball. Okay, if you did do that, if you threw it on the water. So the proverb was, throw it out on the water. You won't be able to control it, but it'll come back to you. Moral of the story is, take a risk. It is a calculated risk, but take the risk. You can't control the bread once it's on the water, but you just be patient. It'll come back to you. Do you ever feel like, you know, I'm trying to do something here, and I'm not seeing the benefit of it. I think it's the right thing to do, but it's sort of a risk on my part. I might lose out in the process. And so... after a while of not seeing the immediate return, we tend to say to ourselves, well, I'm just not going to risk anymore. Wisdom from Solomon, go ahead and take some calculated risks. Interesting how when you're younger, you tend to want to do that a little more, and the older you get, the more you want to circle the wagons. We'll talk about getting older here in just a minute. But the first moral of the story is if you want to invest your life, be willing to take a risk. Be willing to do something. Cast your bread upon the water. Go ahead and invest. And I'm not talking about money now, of course. It's all the way across the boards when you talk wisdom literature. Go ahead and take a chance on doing something that you might fail in, but you would be failing at trying something good instead of succeeding at doing something bad. It's better to fail trying to do something good than to succeed at doing nothing, right? Right? Okay, yeah, are you guys out there? That's what he's saying, take the risk. And yet people are unwilling to risk. This is one of my favorite quotes, and you've heard me use it before, but I'm going to use it again because I just love it. Tough. You can live on bland food so as to avoid an ulcer, drink no tea or coffee or other stimulants in the name of health. Go to bed early, stay away from nightlife, avoid all controversial subjects so as to never give offense. Mind your own business and avoid involvement in other people's problems. Spend money only on the necessities and save all you can. You can still break your neck in the bathtub and it would serve you right. I love that. Can you imagine living a super careful life your whole life and then die all of a sudden? And you get to the end, you go, wait a minute. I would have done this and I would have done that and I would have risked this if I'd have known. See, well, that's exactly what Solomon's getting at. And furthermore, that same piece of wisdom is going to be repeated in several things that we'll see this evening in this chapter. Take the risk. There's a time to take a calculated risk, to step out in faith and take a shot at it. Not foolishly, and Solomon is anything but foolish about this, and we'll see that there's a balance to this. But folks, Christians are sometimes so conservative, so uptight. You know, it's no wonder other people look at them and they think, man, how can that be? I trust God more than that person, and I don't even know him, you know. And yet Christians are worried about details. They're worried about their own details. They're worried about everybody else's details. They're worried about the world's details. They're worried about the ozone layer. Folks, trust God. God is there. So take a little, it's okay to risk. You can't live a life without risk. You can't. You're going to have problems. You might as well have them while you're on the way somewhere. Then just wait for the problems to catch you where you are. Does this make sense? It does make kind of a real down-to-earth kind of sense, doesn't it? Well, then the next thing he says goes right along with it. Divide your portion to 7 or to 8. You don't know what misfortune may occur. You know what this means? Diversify. That's what it means. Divide your portion to 7 or to 8. Diversify. Get involved in more than one thing because you don't know what's going to go wrong in the world. And stuff is going to go wrong. So it'd be good for you if you had more than one interest in life. Because chances are something will go wrong. You won't be able to do that one interest. So have a couple. Invest your life in more than one thing. Spread it out a little bit. Open it up a little bit. Don't be so narrow about everything. It's a great, great piece of advice. Do different things. Learn new things. When was the last time you learned anything really new? When was the last time you, as a grown-up, now I'm talking to grown-ups, I'm talking about some people who've majored in grown-up for like 40 years. Some of you are super grown-up, okay? When was the last time you ever learned anything really new, took up a new challenge? For most grown-ups, the last time they took up a new challenge was when they had to, when they were in college. Unless their career went south on them and they had to develop a new career. But most grown-ups will not voluntarily learn anything brand new. You know why? The older we get, the less we like being beginners. And the longer you stay in what you know, the better you get at it, the less you have to put up with being a beginner at anything. So we say, I don't have to learn anything new. And if I do have to learn anything new, I don't want to. I'm going to drag my feet. I'm going to kick and scream about it. And yet God often changes our life in such a way that he forces us to learn new skills. And instead of embracing that, instead of diversifying, instead of spreading out our portion to 7 and to 8 and really learning new stuff, we kick and scream and whine and we say, why do I have to go through this? And then often after we've begun to do it, we say to ourselves, you know, this actually wasn't so bad. I can actually think. What an amazing thing. I was at a gathering one time years ago, and a teacher did something great, which had already happened to me. But it was still neat the way she did it. We were there with our little kids up at Elk Trail School, and I forget which teacher it was, but we all sat down, a bunch of parents, you know, and they're going to explain what's going on at the school, and our little kids are there and everything. And the teacher took out, she said, take out a piece of paper. And she had a different language, which I think she had made up, actually. And she says, I'm going to teach you something. And she made us write this stuff down that was actually in a different language. And then she wrote it on the board and did this and that. And she says, now what does this say? And really, it forced us to learn something. And the grown-ups are all looking around going, duh, I don't know what it says. And she had just explained it to us as clear as a bell. Very simple. And we all looked at each other like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And then she looked at us and she said, this is what your children feel like when they're learning something new. And I thought, oh, I've been working on stuff I already knew. It's been a long time since I had to learn anything really new. Have you ever tried to learn a new language after being a grown-up? That is a challenge, or a new physical skill, or a new art form, or music. You say, well, I'm too old to learn. No, you're not. We'll talk about that too. You are not too old to learn new stuff. And furthermore, it's all in front of you all the time. God is saying, learn this, do this, come on. You're not ready for the grave yet. You got stuff to do, so spread it out. Embrace it. Take the risk. Moral of the story, first two verses. Invest your life rather than hoarding it. Verses 3 through 6, here's the next piece of wisdom. Do what you can do rather than worrying about what you cannot do. What you'll find is you can do a lot, and probably a lot more than you think you can. So do what you can do, and don't fret about what you cannot do. What we do is we take all of the stuff that's out there that we cannot do and cannot control, and then we use that as a reason for not doing what we can actually do, and even get better at what it is we can actually do. We look at all the impossibilities, and then we say, look at all that impossible stuff. I'm not going to try anything. I'll go watch TV. I can do that. Verses 3 through 6, he says, look, now there's some stuff, right off the bat, he says, there's some stuff you cannot control. Okay, you are not in control of very much stuff around you. If the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. Do you ever try and stop that? Do you ever look at those clouds and say, I got to stop that rain? No. You don't have control of that. And whether a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. Wherever you go, there you are. It's at first you think, duh, but then you think about it again. Try and set that tree back up again. You are not setting that tree back up again. When it's done, it's done. You see, the point is this. There's stuff you don't have control over. When it falls, it falls. When the clouds come, the clouds come. You can't mess with that stuff. What you can do is you can respond to life, but you cannot alter the seasons. You cannot alter the timing of things. When trees fall, they fall. That's it. Furthermore, if you wait until the right time to do everything, you're never going to do it. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Isn't that the truth? Now, I'm going to ask you a real grown-up question. How many of you planned your first baby? Well, am I disappointed? Okay, how many of you did not plan your first baby? Oh, that's better. See, it's a bigger number. You know, how about the second one? How about the fourth one? Boy, the hands are really going to go up there, yeah. You know, I talk to young folks a lot. My own kids who announced recently yet another grandchild on the way. Yay! Yeah, it's the same couple. And my dear daughter called me and I said, honey, now's the time. Have babies. It's a great time to have babies. Now. What about affording it? What about affording it? How many of you could afford it, the first baby you had? If you wait until everything is perfect for everything that happens in your life, you know what? You're not going to do anything in your life. And sometimes God will simply give you that little nudge and you got to move forward before you think you're completely ready for everything in life. It's okay. It's okay. He says, if you wait till everything's perfect, you know, if we'd have waited till it was really perfect for us to come up here and begin what eventually became Trail Christian Fellowship, If we'd have listened, if we'd have looked at the clouds, if we'd have looked at the wind, we'd have never come. Fortunately, we were young enough to not even know where the clouds were. I'm not kidding you. We were so ignorant, we were actually able to trust God. It'll come to you. And that's exactly what I mean. And, you know, I wouldn't do it now because I know too much. I'm too smart to go out and just trust God like I did when we were 26 and moved up here with a handful of savings in an old pickup truck in a recession. I mean, you know, if anybody said, well, I don't, you know, you got to plan this out, get the strategic planning out there, you know, find out, you know, you got to get the demographics of Trail, Oregon. Okay, interview both the folks that are there. Interview them. Get the demographics. You know, if you wait till everything's right and you do all the, you always think of a good reason not to do what it is that often God is simply saying, just do. You know, moving you forward in certain things, and sometimes you'll just make those decisions. Do what you can do rather than worrying about what you can't do. Moving right along. He continues, he says, God is at work in stuff you have no idea what he's doing. He's working behind the scenes. Just as you do not know the path of the wind and how the bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. So just admit it, okay? God's at work providentially, sovereignly, behind the scenes in your life. And stuff you cannot control. And you say, well, I'm a Christian. I ought to be able to know everything God is doing. And until I know everything God is doing, I'm not going to move forward. Or until I think I do. You know, half the time, even when you think you know what God is doing, you have no idea what God is doing. And I know this from experience because pastors are supposed to know this stuff. And I used to pretend. I used to pretend I really knew what God was doing in people's lives. And I've given up. Because just when I thought God was going to do something in somebody's life, he did exactly the opposite. And just when I thought I had it all figured out, he did something completely different. So here's the deal, the wisdom of this, you do what you can do, don't worry about the stuff you can't and the stuff you cannot figure out. People look to pastors, it's so funny. I talk to folks and they'll ask me the heaviest questions in the world. Why would God allow such and so? And I take the question seriously because I know it's coming from a serious heart. It usually has to do with a tragedy. And my honest and true answer is, I have no idea. And they look at me like, well, what do we pay you for? You know? I mean, what did you go to college for? I thought they taught you all about that stuff. No. What they teach you, if they're teaching you the right thing when you're studying for ministry, is they teach you to trust God, which is what I'm teaching. Because there's stuff we cannot figure out. And when we think we've got it figured out, we're in the most danger of all. But we can trust him. And we can live faithfully, amazingly. We can live faithfully and even joyfully and successfully by his standards in this life without figuring everything out. If we just do what comes to our hand, we just do what is right at the time and not try and figure everything else out, try and control stuff like fallen trees that we can't control. So, he says, and this is the last point, stay busy in a productive pursuit. And trust God to bring the increase. And that's in verse 6. Look at this. This is such a great verse. Sow your seed in the morning and don't be idle in the evening. In other words, sow a little in the morning, sow a little in the evening. And I got to believe he means more than just daytime. It's got to be your whole life. Do something good when you're young and do something good when you're older. For you don't know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good. You know, I didn't expect that last line. In Ecclesiastes, I expect him to say, you don't know if morning or evening will be good or if both of them alike will fail. That's kind of how I think of life. I'm, you know, a half-empty glass kind of guy sometimes. I thought that's what he was going to say, and he turned it around. Did you notice that? That last line was a surprise. He says, so in the morning, invest your life. Go ahead and do what you can do. Take the shot. You know, and then and keep doing it. You're getting older. Keep investing. Keep doing good stuff. Maybe you're doing something different than you were when you 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. Okay, fine, but keep doing something good. Because you don't know where the best stuff is going to be. Maybe the best stuff in your life is going to be what you sowed for the Lord when you were younger. Maybe the best stuff in your life is going to be what you're sowing for the Lord when you're older. You have no idea. And you don't know how long you're going to live. So just keep it up. Keep investing. Keep doing it. And maybe it'll all. Maybe the crops will come in from all of that sowing. See? Great. Great word. Let me ask you something. What are you doing for the next 10 years? I mean, really thinking about what the next 10 years of your life is going to look like. So, well, I don't know. I'm worried about tomorrow. You know, the decisions you're making right now are going to serve you in the next 10 years. A famous athlete once said, if I'd have known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. See, a lot of times we don't say to ourselves, how do I want to be 10 years from now? I'm going to start investing. I'm going to sow in the morning. Because 10 years from now, I want to be able to do this or this or this. I'm looking forward to being 10 years older than I am now. A lot of us are just scared to be 10 years older than we are now. And we've stopped sowing. We've stopped planning. We tell everybody else, but we've stopped planning for a productive life 10 years from now or 20 years. You say, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't worry about that because kind of getting up in years anyway, and maybe I should just circle the wagons. Let me give you a little reminder. This is from J. Oswald Sanders in a book called Robust in Faith. He's a great author if you ever get a chance to read his stuff. Listen to what he says. Forgive all these long quotes, by the way. I'm sorry. I don't do this all the time, but there's just some good ones I want to share with you, okay? He says this, four major poets who lived to be over 80 years of age did more work in the last decade of their lives than between the ages of 20 and 30. William Gladstone took up a new language when he was 70. At 83, he became the Prime Minister of Great Britain for the fourth time. At 83, Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote Crossing the Bar when he was 80. John Wesley was 88 and still preaching daily with eminent success, eloquent power, undiminished popularity at 88. Every day. Michelangelo painted his world-famous The Last Judgment at 66. Canon C.H. Nash founded the Melbourne Bible Institute, trained 1,000 young men and women for Christian service, and then retired at the age of 70. So then at 80, he received assurance from the Lord that he'd have a few more years to minister. During those years, he was uniquely blessed in a ministry of Bible teaching to key groups of clergy and laymen, probably the most fruitful years of his life. Those were his 80s. So, okay, figure what your life is right now. I don't know where you are, how close to 80 you might be. And think in terms of this guy basically starting his most productive years at 80. Then, when he was nearly 90, the author found him completing the reading of Volume 6 of Toynbee's Monumental History, just as a mental exercise, at 90. Mr. Benjamin Ryrie retired as a missionary to China at the age of 70. When he was 80, he decided to learn New Testament Greek. He became proficient at New Testament Greek. At 90, he attended a refresher course in Greek. When he was 100, this author was presenting a paper at this particular meeting, and he came across Mr. Ryrie. In his pocket was a small, well-worn Greek lexicon, which he used to brush up on his Greek when he was traveling. Now, that's a guy who's not letting his mind just stop. Folks, you're not over the hill. You may have a good view, but you are not over the hill. If your mind is working, you can work it. You know, recent research has reminded us, really, that the mind is like a muscle, and it can actually improve. I know some of you are wondering about yourself, and perhaps others you might be wondering about. But barring illness, mental illness occasionally, by exercising your mind and continuing to press on and continuing to take new challenges, you actually do yourself a huge favor. You can stay sharp and you can keep growing, and you have no idea what God may have planned for you. The people running this world right now are all probably older than you are. They're all in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. The people, men and women, doing the thinking that is running culture today are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and some in their 90s. And that's probably older than at least half the folks in this room. And some of us are thinking to ourselves, well, that's about enough for one lifetime. Think again. So he says, do what you can do and keep at it. Don't stop. Do what you can do rather than worrying about what you can't do. Here's the third piece of advice, verses 7 and 8. Enjoy every part of your life to the fullest rather than wasting it worrying about the end. Enjoy every part of your life to the fullest rather than wasting it worrying about the end. Verse 7, the light is pleasant. It is good for the eyes to see the sun. Don't you love that in February in Oregon to hear that? Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all. Let him just enjoy every single one of them. Do you ever have somebody, I remember distinctly when our girls were young, talking to an older couple. Actually, matter of fact, they were in their 70s at the time. And they had also raised a house full of girls. And I was talking about our kids, and they were probably 8 and 10 or something like that at the time. And both the man and the woman looked at me and said, oh, that is such a precious age. You know, you need to enjoy every day with those kids right now. How many of you received counsel like that? How many of you given counsel like that now? Yeah, yeah, you receive it, and at the time you're thinking, yeah, I'll let them stay with you for a few days. Wouldn't that be okay? But then you get a little older and you look back and you say, no, I should have enjoyed it more. How often we look back and we say, I should have enjoyed every year. I should have looked for the things to enjoy. Because as the years go by, if we waste our time worrying about what might go wrong, or how short life is. We waste life. The point is this, life is too short to worry about how short it is. Does that make sense to anybody but me? Life is too short to worry about how short it is. And that's really kind of what he's getting at here. He says, let him remember the days of darkness. In other words, remember, life is short. There's going to come a time when you're not going to be able to do it. Those days of darkness will be many. And everything that is to come will be futility. In other words, there's coming an end to these things. And that looks depressing, but he is not depressed by this. What he is saying is enjoy every part of life to the fullest. And there's a balance to this, and we'll see what that balance is. Let me ask you another question. How are you enjoying life right now? Amen from Leo. I won't ask you your age. But we'll take it from a wise man, younger every day. You know, what are you doing? Are you spending a lot of time worrying about the changes that God has forced sovereignly into your life? Instead of looking for the good things that God is doing and enjoying them, really taking the time to savor some of them? You know, we worry about all the stuff, all of the untied up ends of all the things. And you know what? The older you get, the more loose ends there are. The more things you wish you could just tie them up nice and neat. But your life gets bigger and more stuff falls off your desk just the older you get. It's, you know what? If you don't take the time to just shut the door to the study sometimes, you know, slam that file drawer, just shut it, And go in and give somebody a hug and take the time to think it through and take the time to enjoy it, you're wasting precious time. You think you're going to make your life longer by worrying about it? You think you're going to increase the quality of it by fretting over the fact that it's going to come to an end someday? That's what a lot of times we do. We fret over the fact it's going to come to an end someday. And then something in our life has changed and it can never be, the tree has fallen and we can't put it back on the stump again. And we look back and we say, you know, if I had it to do over again, among godly people, the one thing they say is, I would have enjoyed some of those things a little better. I would have taken a little more time. Well, that's what he's saying. Life is too short to worry about how short it is. So take the time to enjoy all the good that God has given you right now. Yes, dark days are going to come one way or another. There's hard times in life, but there's also a lot of good times in life. And one thing Solomon's very good at is saying the good times in life are worth savoring and worth saying those were good. And these, part of these are good too. So let's use these. Let's invest them now. Last piece of advice. And you're going to see in verses 9 and 10, just a good, really good balance. Live fully to the glory of God. Live fully to the glory of God, rather than bargaining your eternity for today's pleasure. Now, here's the balance. Because, you know, you hear what I've been saying, and then really sort of what Ecclesiastes does say, and some of Proverbs. And you think, well, is he really saying that I should just, you know, blow my wad, just get out there and do whatever, you know? Not exactly. The best lived lives, the most joyful lives, are actually lives with a certain amount of discipline in them that don't waste themselves. You know, you get the best enjoyment by pacing yourself and staying within a real commitment to God. And that's why I made that statement. Live fully to the glory of God rather than bargaining your eternity for today's pleasure. When he says live your life and enjoy it, he doesn't mean bargain your eternity for it. He means within the parameters that God lays down for us. And that's in verses 9 and 10. Rejoice, young man, during your childhood. Let your heart be pleasant during the days of your young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. You read that and you go, oh, no, no, he couldn't mean this. Well, he doesn't mean it the way you think, if that's what you're thinking. He says, yet know that God will bring you into judgment for all these things. First time I've read that was years ago. And I thought, well, what a bummer. On the one hand, he says, go for it. And on the other hand, he says, and God's just going to kill you for it. I thought, oh, good grief. I don't want to read this book again. And I discovered that's not what he means. He means the impulses that you know God would approve of. And he tells us what they are. And a godly person has a lot of joy that they can follow in their lives. And that's why he puts that last line in there. He says, know that God will evaluate it all. So don't do anything stupid that God is going to say, that was really stupid. Don't do that. Don't sin. Commit your life to God. Live honorably, but enjoy it. That's what he's getting at. So remove vexation from your heart. Lighten up would be our, you know, get a life. Put away pain from your body. Amen? Take drugs? No. Put away pain from your body. Because childhood, now look at his reasoning. Because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. Yeah, life is short. It is short. And the older you are, the more rapidly it seems to move. So while you have health, and while you have brains, and while you're moving along in your life, enjoy it, invest it, but commit your way to God. Commit your way completely to him. And then whatever he tells you to do, do it well. Have a good time at it. Because he really intended you to. This last portion, I think, is one of the great balances. And I want to read a little story to you to close. Listen to what, it is a true story. An older Christian man, a lawyer, had an opportunity to talk with the son of his partner, one of his colleagues in the law office, came to him, the son of one of his colleagues. Did you ever talk to the kids of one of your friends? It's an interesting opportunity. It's an interesting opportunity because you know what? People who are in that position where you can talk to the kids of one of your friends sometimes can say things mom and dad can't get away with. And that's exactly what this lawyer says to this young man, college-age young man. He happened to know that the boy had drifted from his previous commitment to Christ, and so he decided to ask what was happening in his life. How do you like the university, Harold? He asked. Oh, fine, Harold replied. I'm crazy about it. You're very fortunate to have the opportunities for education, said the older man. Yes, sir. I know it, and I hope I'm appreciating it fully. The older friend pressed gently forward. Harold, what are you planning to do when you graduate? Promptly, he answered, I'm going to go to law school. Fine. What then? Oh, of course, I'm planning to practice law. I hope one day to be a law partner with you and my father. Excellent. What are you going to do then? The old lawyer pressed. Oh, well, I plan to get married. In fact, I have a girl, and we're pretty serious already, said Harold proudly. Anything else? Said the older man. Well, I'm determined to make a success of it so I can succeed to the business when you and Dad retire. That sounds good. What are you going to do then? Well, I hope to make the practice of law pay well and I want to accumulate sufficient income for a comfortable home and give my kids the best kind of education and lay up something for old age. Harold was losing some of his confidence as the questions persisted. The old man waited, and then he said, "What then?" "Well, I suppose when I get older, I'll retire, like you and Dad." There was a thoughtful silence between them now. "What then?" asked the questioner. There was a long silence. Harold said softly, "Then I'll die." There was another silence. The old man leaned gently forward and asked in a kind tone, "What then?" Harold thought seriously for a few moments. Then he stood and he extended his hand. "Thank you," he said carefully. That was all, just thank you. And he left. Later that night, he recommitted his life to Christ. Good wisdom. Good wisdom. There's much in life to be enjoyed. And there's much success to be had. And God offers wisdom. And he wants us to enjoy our lives. But the life that is good, the life that brings joy, is always built, even in Solomon's kind of dark journal here. He always gets back to the idea that, my friend, you've got to be committed to God first. It all belongs to him. And only then will you be able to enjoy it. Let's bow our heads. Father, we thank you that you care about daily life. And we see it in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes especially. We see the hopelessness that the world tries to alleviate with the frantic activity. And we also see the hope that you offer to us in physical life, though this life is temporary here. Lord, we want to live wisely and we want to live well. We want to have the texture of life that shows wisdom and tremendous joy, enjoying the sunshine and every blessing you give us, while at the same time being fully and totally committed to your glory and to your honor. This is a balance that is not always easy for us, Lord. And we ask you to help us with it. We trust you and we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.